It's 8 o'clock. Let's have an AA meeting. Okay. My name is Chris Ward. I'm a grateful recovered alcoholic. Welcome to the Monday Night Blue Shift Speakers Meeting at the NABA Club, where a member of Alcoholics Anonymous with 1 year or more of sobriety tells his or her story. All right. This reading is based on a passage from page 29 of the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous. Each individual in our own personal stories describes in their own language and from their own point of view the way they establish their relationship with God. These give a fair cross-section of our membership and a clear-cut idea of what has happened in their lives. We hope no one will consider these self-revealing accounts in bad taste. Our hope is that many alcoholic men and women in our room tonight and listening later on aabluechipspeakers.org desperately in need will hear our speaker, and we believe that it is only by fully disclosing ourselves and our problems that any of us shall be persuaded to say, yes, I am one of them too. I must have this thing. So, tells me to introduce the speaker. Okay. Tonight, we have Bob R. is going to come up and speak, and this is how humble Bob is. I was in the bathroom with him earlier. And men of genius... Okay, let me start up. Men of genius have wonderful conversations while standing at the urinals. I asked Bob, I said, give me one good thing to tell everybody about you tonight before I go up there. And he's so humble, he couldn't come up with anything. So, but I know that him and Frank always have contests when he has the best bite. So we're going to hear his story tonight. And with that, I'll give you Bob R.
Hi, I'm Bob. I'm an alcoholic.
Hey, Bob.
This is being recorded. but not on video, right?
Not on video.
I want to thank the thousands and thousands of people who have come out. My name is Bob, and I'm an alcoholic.
Hey, Bob.
Sobriety day is July 3rd, 1988, if you want to do the math. I'll wait while everybody's... Actually, I found out recently it was actually July 2nd. I looked at my old book, and my big book, and I had it written down in there. And so for years I've been celebrating on July 3rd, because I guess I forgot. I was drinking back when I got sober. One of the things that always attracted me to AA was the laughter. I'm not feeling so happy tonight, but that's okay. Shit happens. You know, lost somebody I cared a lot about. Relationship issues are happening. You know, finally coming to an end or straightening out, or they're working out the way they're supposed to work out.
That's right.
And there's not one single thought of a drink or drug in my brain.
Mm.
Not one. It doesn't even occur to me. And it took a long time to get there. You know. Let's see. Where do I start? I come from a long, proud tradition of alcoholism in my family. My father was an old life Marine who was thrown out of the military in like the 40s or 50s, and he died alone in a little apartment over a liquor store in Front Royal, Virginia. I think I met him once when I was like 3 years old. So. My father was a life Marine too. When your dad's a life Marine, you either completely conform or completely rebel. Well, guess which one? We used to always have a saying around, my uncle's a Marine too, but he didn't stay in long, but he got shot up. But he was actually an exception, because we had a saying at home, once a Marine, always an alcoholic. So when I was a little kid, you know, the parents would be sitting around there drinking their highballs and their beers, and of course I was always bumming sips of beer here and there and whatever, and it was kind of cute and all that sort of thing, but... Oh, and by the way, if anyone's offended by substances other than alcohol, then sorry. It says my point of view. We're here talking my story. And by the way, I'll take this off. I'm not here representing the Association of Recovering Motorcyclists. I'm here recovering. I'm here representing myself as a recovering alcoholic. So I'll talk about that in a minute, but that's not... That is not a treatment program or anything like that. So I guess that my brain is a little scrambled, but I guess that hopefully we'll we'll get through this together. So, just like I've gotten through everything else, together with people like you in rooms like this. So anyway, when I hit 12, I couldn't wait. I mean, I wanted to be a hippie. I just couldn't wait to get out there and smoke marijuana and all this kind of stuff. But the closest I came was I had this little newspaper route. I'd get up at like 5 a.m. and deliver newspapers before I went to school. And my mother had these pills to lose weight. Now, this is a long time ago, so I don't know what was in those pills, but I took one. Whoa. And then I stayed up all night long. Next day I took three. You know. Never. I don't do anything part way, right? And that was my first real experience with taking something to really make change the way I felt, or change something about me chemically. And in my teenage years, yeah, I eventually found the weed and the drugs and the Quaaludes and the you-know-what, you know. And I always said, well, I'm never going to inject any drugs until I injected drugs, you know. And I wasn't, most drugs, I loved the psychedelics and all that. And I'll just say this and get it over with so if anyone's feeling uncomfortable. But like downers, I liked anything I could get my hands on. Some kid gave me pills one day in high school. And he said, what is it? And I asked him what it was. He said, I think they're downers. And I took a bunch of them and I went to school and I didn't think about it. I lived in this little town. It was 10th grade, and I was in this little town called Del Mar, Maryland, which is on the border. Population 3,500. The high school I went to was from grade 7 through 12. And I forgot all about it until I went to the bathroom. I peed, and my urine was like a bright green color. And I got a quarter, and I went and found it, and I made this anonymous phone call to the town doctor. Right? Because I thought I was going to die. Right? And he listened. I said, I don't know what it is. Mine's green. He said, well, he started chuckling. He said, you probably got the cleanest kidneys in town. You know, stop taking drugs. And then hung up. And that was about it. I stayed pretty much wasted through high school as much as I could. School was easy for me for some reason. I just kind of read the books at the beginning of the year and never did homework or anything like that. As long as I had a B, I didn't care. I was a rebel, you know, would stand up, refuse to. Vietnam was going on. And I refused to salute the flag. And I was, you know, my father, of course, was a lifer Marine. When he came out, he was a chief warrant officer, which is a badass, you know. But, and that's kind of how I got through high school. I thumbed all over the country. The minute school was out for the year, I would take off. It drove my mother crazy. And basically lived on my own over the summer, bumming around, getting in trouble. You know, somehow I never got arrested for anything. So, in fact, I know we all talk about, you know, how long we've been in prison. I only spent one night in jail, and it wasn't my fault. We come up here, and I hear people, and they, oh, I spent 30 days in jail, or I spent 6 months in jail. I call that one downsmanship, you know. We try to outdo each other with how bad things were. You know, I got a buddy who was talking about sitting in a meeting, and this guy said, I used to live in a cardboard box. And the next guy looked at him and said, you had a box? You know? So, again, it's the humor. Eventually, I grew up a little bit. I didn't want to join the military, so I joined the Air Force. And I was stationed in Turkey. And I love Turkey because you're on base and the booze is cheap, the cigarettes are cheap, and there was a lot of other chemical stuff around there that was really awesome at the time. And that's what I did. And before it was over with, though, they were going to send me to Biloxi, Mississippi after that first tour, and I didn't want to go. And I managed to actually get out of the military, be thrown out of the military with an honorable discharge. I joined, I think it's 11 days before the cutoff. Technically, I am a Vietnam-era veteran. But, you know, and I always looked at it back and said, you know, I never signed up for VA. I signed up for VA benefits finally about 2 years ago. But I can't get them because I make too much money or whatever. I felt it was like stolen valor. And a buddy of mine who's also in the program said, you know, every group, every organization, they have that one fuck-up. And if you hadn't done it, they would have had to pick somebody else. So you did, you know, you served your country. But that's how we do things here. We take something, and instead of seeing just this, we see it from this side, and we see it from this side, and we see it from the other side. We get different perspectives. If nothing else, that's what a sponsor does for you. And that's what your running buddies do for you and your friends or whatever at the meetings. Because someone will throw a topic out there, and people will come at it from different directions and give you a three-dimensional view of something instead of a two-dimensional view of something. And that's what we get here. That's why we come here, because it averages us out. I came here, and I mean, I wasn't going to not come here. My ego wouldn't let me stay home, right? Okay, but still. But knowing that I was going to be here, knowing I was going to have to talk, I've done this enough times to know that everything I write down, everything I think about in advance, I'm going to talk about this, I'm going to talk about that. None of that ever happens, so I've given up, you know. But I get fed here. I get fed here because I sit here amongst people that know what it's like to have lived through some of the things I've lived through. The names and places and dates may be different, but the feelings are there. By the time I got here, I wanted to die. I literally wanted to die. I was drinking myself sober on a regular basis. I reached the point to where I had to drink to function. I had reached the point, there's a movie called Leaving Las Vegas. And there's this scene where he goes in there, he can't even write a check. And then a little while later, he comes back and everything's fine. I know that feeling. Because until you can get that first couple of drinks, I wasn't there that long, luckily. But I got married, woman who's just a party animal like I was. So I don't really think she's an alcoholic, but she sure could drink, you know, when she needed to. And that's what we did, basically. We partied all the time. I had a little boy, and or my stepson. Who, by the way, now is just going to retire in about a year and a half as a Green Beret, of all things. But proud of him. And I had it all set. I worked for this computer software company down in Florida. And I had the wife, I had the stepson, I had the cars, the two cars that were paid for, but whatever. We were kind of making the payments on it. And I remember driving home, and I would come around. We were running just half of a duplex, and I would come around the garages. And I'd always be looking to see that little light, the doorbell light. Because there were a lot of times I came around there and that light would be out. Because I would sit there and I'd write the check for the electric bill and I'd mail it off. But somehow I would get to the bank before it did. And I'd say, oh, fuck. And I would spring into action. And there'd be no money because it wasn't payday. Somehow I would go out and con or finagle or whatever, or bounce a check or something. And get that $72 or whatever it was and get it to the place just at the last minute, and they would come out and they would switch on the electric, and I would pat myself on the back that I'm good in a crisis. The fact that I caused the crisis, you know, it's like setting fire to a house and then being the hero because you go in and you warn the people to get out, you know. I mean, and it was hell. Because deep down inside, I felt empty. Deep down inside, I felt like everything was a charade. Everything was a front. Everything was, you know, I got to have these things. I got to keep the car running. I got to have the wife and kid and all that. And finally, they had enough of it. I traveled a lot, and I'd be gone for like 2 weeks at a time. And finally, the day came. A buddy of mine picked me up. We went to the airport. And I came home 4 days early, 3 days early. I thought, I'll surprise my wife. I came home 3 days early. She was at work. You know, my car was out there or whatever. So I'm hanging up my clothes in the closet, and I see three or four shirts in there. And I thought, wasn't that sweet of her? She bought me some clothes while I was gone. That's not quite what was going on. So you can put two to two together. So at the time, I was horrible. You know, you learn to reframe things. At the time, I was devastated and all that. The fact was, she wasn't married to anybody. She was married to an alcoholic. I cared more about my drinking and drugs than anything else. And at the time, it was a horrible, horrible thing and all that, and I'd never forgive her and all that. That's been so long ago, I've forgiven her and everything, because I just look at it differently now. I was just in an open marriage. I just didn't know about it, right? Because I've been in open relationships. So. But anyway, that was. I moved out. I ended up spending about a month with someone I worked with as a roommate. And by that time, I was drinking constantly. I'd lost all kinds of weight and everything, and I was barely getting to work. And one thing led to another. My wife, I'll keep it really short. My wife says, Bob Meadows, he's long since gone. He always said, if you're not sober by 8:30, you're running behind. So, yeah, anyway. The amazing people I meet here. Yeah. But, and he's still part of this. I didn't know him all that well, but I remember him. Yeah. He always said, don't pray for to get sober unless you really want to get sober. Yeah. So, but because it works. So, anyway. I got sober. I stopped drinking that June. I was going to meetings all the time. But I had this stepson, and it just broke my heart. And my ex-wife would pull all this bullshit about it. We were getting a divorce and all this kind of stuff, which was just emotional warfare and everything. Finally, Christmas rolled around, and through all this very delicate negotiations, I was going to be allowed to bring him his Christmas gifts on Christmas Day. 20 minutes, no more. My wife was going to be there. My kid was going to be there. You know, her boyfriend wasn't going to be there. And I skipped over the suicide attempt, but anybody that knows, anybody's here, is, you know, probably knows this. Anyway, and I had a sponsor, and I would tell him, well, I'm finally going to go, and I got him this, and I got him that, and I got him some clothes. And he said, what did you get for your ex-wife? Nothing. Fuck her. I'm not going to get her anything. Excuse my language. I was trying to be good. Whatever. He insisted I get something. I went to this store called Kmart in Florida. Now, this is 1988. And I went in there, and they had this big thing. It was this salad bowl set, the plastic salad bowl with a big fork and a spoon and four little plastic bowls. And it was like $8, and it was wrapped already, which to me was, so I bought the damn thing, you know. And we go there, and I say, I give the kid his stuff, my Michael, and I said, here. And I left, basically. No big deal, just left. That was the beginning of being able to start to spend time with my stepson. Just that small gesture. I didn't understand why I should do it. It didn't make any sense to me. I sure as hell didn't want to do it. But I did it. 13 years in a row, that woman received a salad bowl set from me. She called me up and I said, please, no more salad bowls. Because she was giving it one day. One year it was all wood. One year it was a $350 cut glass bowl from Tiffany's. And she was afraid of it. She's afraid she was going to break it or whatever. But we have a good relationship now. You know, she's a cancer patient. She's in my house. She smokes weed. I don't give a fuck what she does in my house when she's a cancer patient. You know, when she comes to visit. And again, sorry. There's people that probably didn't come here because I have a tendency to. No one censored me when I came to AA. When I came to AA, I had feelings and emotions I had no vocabulary for, and the serenity prayer didn't work, and no one told me, what's your language? At least not where I was at. And we got to be careful when we do that, I believe. I've been around a lot longer. I should clean up my act a little more, and I try to, and sometimes it slips out. But that was the beginning. That's how we do. We do these things that don't make any sense at all. You know? So anyway, and then I found AA. I spent 5 days in a suicide attempt, 5 days in a psych ward. They kicked me out, and I had no place to go. Had a job, had a car, everything I owned fit in the back of a little car that had been towed away. But it was payday, and they had ATMs then, and I got a cab to this place called the Rebo's Club in Castleberry, Florida. It was a two-story building, and I remember pulling up there wondering how much they charged for the rooms upstairs. You know, of course, they had none of that. And it was like 1:30 on a Saturday afternoon or Friday afternoon. There was this old guy. It's always an old guy, right? Sitting there, and I went in there, and I started to tell him all my woes and all the problems because of that woman and this and woman and that, and we finally got down to it, and he says, well, it's not the how many drinks does it take to get you drunk? And I was a little confused, because there was times I could drink 3 drinks and be looped, but normally I just lived on alcohol. It was just part of, at the moment I'd been dried out. I'd had 3 drinks the day I got out of the psych ward, right? I was a high bottom, right, I thought. You know, 2 Heinekens and a double shot of Stolichnaya, right? Because I was sophisticated. But I was drinking it in a day's in. So. Not very sophisticated. Anyway. And I said, well, I can drink a case of beer. which is true, you know. And he says, well, you know, whether it takes 3 drinks or 5 drinks or 24 drinks to get you drunk, you will not get drunk if you don't have the very first one. I've got IQ tests. Supposedly I'm supposed to be halfway smart, right? I did computer stuff and all that kind of stuff and whatever. That wouldn't have occurred to me in a million years. And I said the classic thing to this man. I said, I don't think I could stand never getting drunk again for the rest of my life. He says, neither could I. He had about 8 years. His name is Rudy Carmack. And I've tried to find him since, and I guess he's passed along. But he says, that's why we just do it one day, just for one day. And that year, later that year, this movie came out. It was called Living Sober. And I always forget his name. The black guy with the freckles.
Morgan
Freeman. He's in every single movie. And he's talking to his addict while he's peeing into a cup. And he says, we do it 5 minutes at a time. 5 more minutes. And I hung on to that. And there were times I wanted to abuse, I wanted to drink, I wanted to whatever. But I can wait 5 minutes. I can wait for 5 minutes. And I would distract myself. I'd turn on a TV if I had one. I'd pick up a phone. I'd get whatever. I would pick up a book and read it. And the next thing I know, 45 minutes have gone by. I'd start over 5 minutes from now. And I would do that. That was, I think, May 28th or May 29th. A few days later, I'm out with one of my running buddies, and he's going back to talk to his ex-wife who threw him out. And someone hands me a joint. I didn't think twice about it. You know. And I went to the meeting next day, and I said, you know, I smoked some weed last night. I don't have to pick up white chip, do I? I said, yeah, you don't pick up white chips. And then about a week later, I got some weed, you know, and I was smoking it, you know, and then asked for topic, and I said, you remember it was legal, and he laughed it, you know. I said, pick up white chip, Bob. And then later on, I get, you know, get high again, you know, pick up a white chip, Bob. I either had to quit smoking pot or quit mentioning it in AA meetings. I had a little bit of money and I bought 2 tickets to the Firecracker 400 at Daytona Beach that year. And I couldn't get anybody to go with me. Because either guys around the AA club, I'd been going about 4 or 5 weeks, they knew me. They knew who I was. And, you know, it's like they told me later, you know, my disease was stronger than. So I smoked my last marijuana cigarette there. It sounds like the cop talking. Right? I smoked my last joint there. There's a little plaque, you know, I don't know. But anyway. That's just a joke. So. And about 2 weeks later, I realized, well, if there's no out, there is no way I can do anything now to change how I'm feeling inside. When your father's a life marine, they yell at you all the time. He would inspect my room when I was 4 years old. There was always something wrong. You will never get anything right. There's no point in even trying. You'll fuck it up. 3, sorry. Anyway, so I had issues. But I had a lot of resentments. I had resentments towards my ex-wife. I had a lot of fears. I had a lot of all this stuff. And I would go to 3 meetings a day, every single day. I did 90 and 30 or whatever. We say 90 and 90. If that's too much, just go to 1 and 1 90 times in a row and you'll be all, you know. And that's what I did. I basically lived in the AA clubhouse because I had no place else to go. The so-called friends I had, they were all in a bar somewhere drinking. You know, I had my support group for drinking. You know, they figured, well, I guess I'll have a support group. For... And we even had our slogans sitting there at the bar. I'd rather have a bottle in front of me than a funnel lobotomy, you know. But... And little by little, the 30 days later, I finally got a sponsor, someone who consented to be my sponsor because he's telling me y'all doing all that stuff and he wasn't going to waste his time. And that man went crazy. He literally went crazy. I worked steps 1, 2, 3 and started 4 with him, and I went to an open AA meeting and he had never seen him chair a meeting before, and he was literally having a psychological problem, serious ones, to the point to where before it was over with, some of the old timers called an ambulance and took him away that night. I had this backup sponsor, so I promoted him. And I worked steps 3 again, 4, 5, 6, and 7 with that man. And he hated women. Just really did. He was a con man. He made all his money conning people out of money. You know, multi-level marketing things. Selling things that you put in your car for like $80. It was basically a plastic bottle full of water that was supposed to give you great gas mileage, whatever. And eventually I had to get out of that because, you know, I went out with a girl and he went crazy. And I said, you have to get your program out of my pants. And that was the end of that sponsorship relationship. And then I got a mature sponsor. The reason I say that is that both of these people were sick and ill people. But working the steps worked. Because the message is what matters. The steps are what works here. You know, I have problems. You know, we all have problems. None of us is perfect here. No one's a shining example of recovery and sobriety and whatever, mental health. But the steps are what's worth. It's the principles of this program. I came in here and I said, I can't do this thing. I'm an atheist. I don't believe in all that religious stuff, all that hocus pocus. And they kept saying, you don't have to. 28 years later, I still, my religious beliefs haven't changed. But as far as the God thing, I'm fine with it. You know, it used to really drive me crazy when I heard, God this, God that. And I used to hear people that stand at the podium, they'd say, well, I can't know God, it's not a self-atheist. And then I found God. And I think, eventually someone's going to tell me I've got to go and get religion or something. And frankly, some people did tell me that, you know. Well, I'm still clean and sober. You know, I don't know where they are, but... Because the higher power, again, is those principles. It's not just that everybody in this room can go out and use tonight. It's not necessarily just the people. The fellowship is so important, but the principles that I'd stay away from one drink for one day. That's what it's about. I did that fourth step. I did the fifth step. I remember I left something out of that fourth step because I was so ashamed of it. And I did steps 7 and 8. And I used that fourth step, and I went back over these things that I'd written out in my fourth step to find out what was it about me and my personality that put me in those situations in the first place. And I learned that the bigger the resentment, the more I had to do with it. The bigger my part in it. I learned about how afraid I was of things. I learned about how I wanted to control things. You know, and it's all right there in the book. It's just that, you know, that was for other people because I was way too smart for this place. But, you know, by the heart, I had to learn everything the hard way. I used to think they ought to add it. If they ever rewrite the big book, they should write a chapter about me. Called Don't Let This Happen to You, you know. And because I was defiant about everything to this day. And I remember, like, the first time I told the truth when I could have told a lie and felt like I invented something. Yeah. You know, we haven't invented anything here. And realize how much easier my life goes when I try to live a life that's honest and has integrity. And then over the years, different things matter to me. A couple of years sober, there was this son of a bitch over at this other AA club. He was a 13-stepper. Son of a bitch, 13-stepper. I went to my sponsor about him. Fucker, this 13-stepper. He said, by the way, Bob, you've done the resentments and you've done your fears. You never did the fourth step on your sex conduct. What's that got to do with it? Do it. And I did it. And I realized my definition of a 13th step was anybody I thought was having sex with somebody I wanted to have sex with. Yeah. All about control. All about wanting to run the show. All about wanting to, you know, all about this. It's so revealing, you know, so embarrassing, but it's so revealing a lot of times. They say there's always that one son of a bitch in the meeting, you can't stand him. You ever grit your teeth when he opens his mouth or her mouth? My sponsor says, that's a person you need to go shake his hand afterwards. And every time I say just in a meeting, I shake someone's hand and they say, hey, wait a minute. Because that's the man who can show, he's showing you, he's modeling yourself to you. You know, like I say, if you play anything, you got 3 playing back at you, whatever, all right? Years sober, I started going to adult children of alcoholics. And pretty soon I was going to Codependence Anonymous and alcohol and Narcotics Anonymous, whatever. I went to NA for 3 years, right? I was going to Debtors Anonymous and I didn't even owe anybody any money, you know. I would turn into like a Stuart Smalley or something. And eventually the child within had to grow up a little bit. I did some therapy and all that about the family of origin stuff. You know, I had my teddy bear and everything. And looking back, it seems kind of silly, but it was important that I do all that, right? But it's all basically based on the 12 steps. It's just all about finding out who I was and finding out who I was and why I do the things I do, why I'm afraid of the things I'm afraid of. And now I'm not so afraid. Still, to this day, I walk by my boss, the door is closed, and I'm sure he's interviewing my replacement. You know? But now, it used to drive me crazy and it would worry me all the time. Nowadays, it's like no big deal. In fact, I wish you would. Because I wouldn't mind getting out of there because I've been a consultant all my life. Losing jobs is just part of the deal. Yeah. So I'd be bored probably working in the same place. And then I would learn different things. Like it was like my fourth year sober, I spent learning about anger. I bought this road bike, you know, with little tiny tires and with the tight pants, and I would ride that thing and ride it and ride it and ride it and ride hundreds of miles, like 200 miles a week sometimes on that thing. And I would ride back and forth to this AA clubhouse, and I'd have my helmet and my tight little pants and my special shirt, and my shoes were clacking around. You could barely walk in it. And some new person would always come up and say, "So, when do you get your license back?" But it was all about humility. See, it was perfectionism was causing me, because when I'm a perfectionist, I'm judging. I can't accept me and I can't accept you, because judging is when I'm perfectionist against you. I had to learn to accept myself. I had to learn to accept you, too. And sometimes that's easier than others. Sometimes you try to make things work out, and they're just not going to work out. Sometimes you wonder, do I hang on a little more? Do I hang on a little more? And sometimes that works. Sometimes the miracle happens. Sometimes the miracle is you figure out you shouldn't be there in the first place. That you've done everything you can. You know. So perfectionism, I realized, was a big thing. And something that I had to learn past. But it always comes back to one thing, and there's not a 12 and 12 floating around here, but, you know, they have this little card they pass around, the principles behind the 12 steps. In step 7, in this 12 and 12, it says very clearly, it says the fundamental, foundational principle of all the steps is humility. So I'm going to go out and I'm going to make my own cards and say step 1, humility, step 2, humility, step 3, humility, you know, because I got to set everybody straight, you know, it's my job. And that's what it gets down to, because I find that the more I let go of reality, let go of trying to control things, and the more I just try to live my life, the more I try to live a life of integrity, the better things get. About 7 or 8 years ago, I got involved with these guys, the Sober Bikers. It's the Association of Recovering Motorcyclists. And we have our little thing, too, like whatever. But because I love riding motorcycles, and I was riding these. I forget what it says. The point is, it's recovery first. Mm-hmm. There's nothing like a bunch of bikers, you know, sitting around talking about recovery. Mm-hmm. And I've ridden literally all over the world. I've ridden up and down the coast of the Indian Ocean in Australia. Last year it was Norway and Sweden. Every year we go up to Wisconsin and we go all over the place. And, Wisconsin's kind of cool because you hang out with some badass bikers, some real ones. Yeah. There's nothing like seeing a guy about this tall with a 1%er patch on that says, "Holy cow, holy cow." They really say that in Wisconsin. Yeah. So. But it brings you to another. It brings you to another level of accountability, because we say you have to have your ego small enough to fit behind that patch. And I've learned a lot from that. And who knows where the journey is going to go next? So, at the end of the big book, it says there's this chapter. You read the big book, and there's all this intelligence, and all this wisdom, and experience. And it tells you what to do. It just pretty well tells you exactly what to do. It tells you what not to do. Mm-hmm. Like if you're sponsoring somebody, it says you're not a bank. You're definitely not a, you know, you're not a marriage counselor. Mm-hmm. You know, we don't care the alcoholic. You know, we don't serve free meals here for the homeless. It's not what we're here for. I'm a member of the board of directors, so if you have a problem with that, whatever. We have that singleness of purpose. Bill Wilson sat down one day and he made a first draft of these 12 steps, and then the people that were there, they all kind of fought, I guess, and they came up with the big book. It was a group effort. And they put in stuff like As We Understood Him, which allows me to come in. I'm very grateful for that. But a lot of that stuff, you know, wasn't necessarily the first draft that we know today. And that's a good thing, because again, Bill Wilson was a brilliant man, obviously. Some say divinely inspired. That's fine. But it still took a group effort to come up with. That's why it works here, is because it's all of us together. As far as the religion thing, eventually I didn't want to read to the agnostic, because if I knew it was going to tell me, I had to go join some church somewhere. I'm a recovering Catholic, okay? So, and I actually had a date with a girl once a long, long time ago, and she was going to convert me. She was there under, you know, false pretenses, apparently. And she asked me, and I said, "Well, I was a priest. I was a Catholic." And she said, "Oh, I've heard about those priests." I said, no, I was a really ugly little boy. So they didn't. But the point is, though, that it doesn't matter for purpose, in my opinion, for purposes of what we do in here, whether you believe in God or Jesus or Allah or whatever, it doesn't really matter where reality comes from. I read somewhere that if God obeys his own rules, you know, if I take this thing and spill it everywhere, it's going to be spilled everywhere. That's just the laws of physics. Yeah. Just like the laws of, if I take a drink, I'm going to want another drink. I might be able to get away with it one day, but the next day and the next day, and eventually it'll win. Eventually. So. A little more nervous than I thought it was. Yeah. So, you read the big book, and it has all this wisdom, and all this intelligence, and all this experience. And on the last page, on page 164, what does it say? It says, we realize we know only a little. Always back to the humility. Always back to the humility. My problem is when I figure out I got it all figured out. That's when I got a problem. I came in here, and after 90 days, I was going to 3 meetings a day, and I was reading the big book, memorizing page numbers, and didn't matter what topic was. The topic is anger. Oh, it's page 66 of the big book tells us. And I would quote at length from the, you know, all this kind of stuff. And I thought, man, I really got it figured out. Got my red chip, man, I got it really figured out. And then 3 months later, I got my 6-month chip, and I really had it figured out. Man, I don't know what I was thinking back when I had 90 days, but man, now I got to really figure it out. You know? And then finally, I got that year. Man, I really was screwed up back there when I had 6 months. You know? And then 5 years, I got my walking around sense, they called it. 5 years. Man, I was a mess back then. Same with 10 years. Actually, 10 years, I came very close to, it's probably the most depressed I've ever been in my life, seriously. And I met a man in a different clubhouse, and he says, "Bob, you don't seem too happy." I said, "You know, I'm coming up on 10 years, and I mean, I got this condo and everything, but I mean, I should have a house. My car should be paid off. I should have a wife, maybe kids. You know, I had myself fixed a long time ago. I don't know why I want a kid, but whatever. I should have this. I should have that. I should be farther along." He said, "Oh, and this guy, he had like 92 days sober or whatever." He said, "Well, what did you have when you got here?" And we get those wow moments. Especially when you're new. You know, we have these sayings. You know, wherever you go, there you are. Wow! That was one of those wow moments. And I made that guy with his 92 days my sponsor. And I got a lot from talking to that guy. Because, yeah, he was new and all that, but I can learn from people with 92 days, too. You know, and he eventually moved to Florida and everything. But, I can learn from everybody. The best description I ever heard of God, this guy was sitting in a meeting, and the topic was God, and everybody's talking to him, religion, God, and everything, and he says, "I don't know anything about it." He'd just gotten out of jail. He said, "I've just gotten out of jail, and I don't know anything about this God stuff. I just find that events in my life seem to be a direct result of my own actions." How profound is that? When I do the bad thing, when I do the wrong thing, I end up with wrong things. When I'm starting lying or whatever, I'm constantly on guard because I got to keep track of everything and who I said what to. When I'm screwing people over, I got to keep track of who to watch out for and all that. When I don't live like that, I don't have any of those things. My luck improves. My life improves. I'm happier most of the time. Things happen. You know, lost a buddy the other day. You know, I'm more angry than anything else. Yeah, but shit happens. What do you do with that? What do you do when someone passes away like that? So, and I've been here long enough. I've been to some funerals, you know, and some useless funerals. Most of us aren't going to make it. Most of us are going to die drunk or dry drugged or whatever. And for those people, it's incumbent on me to go out and live the biggest, fattest, fullest life I can. That's what I get from that. Because it says somewhere in the big book, I forget the page number, that, you know, there's no sense chasing after somebody who's not interested in what you have to have. And there's always going to be people that aren't going to make it. But we're the lucky ones so far. Because the only person I can get sober and clean is me. When I was really new, I'll skip to the end of that. There was this one guy, I really wished I could get him sober. Because he went out and he got in a car and he killed somebody. A little 4-year-old boy. I thought if I could get anybody sober, it would be him. And I remember thinking, if I only had that power. But if I had the power to get somebody clean and sober, then I'd have to pick out who. I'm glad I don't have that power. The last thing it says in the big book is there's a whole bunch of stuff, but it doesn't talk about it. At the end, you'd think it'd talk about long-term sobriety or not drinking or whatever. No, it says we trudge the road to happy destiny. It doesn't say we trudge the road to become a circuit AA speaker. It doesn't say we trudge the road to wealth and riches. It doesn't say we trudge the road to whatever. It says happy destiny. Because that's the big secret here. Yeah, it starts off talking about alcoholism. But ultimately, it's about being happy. And I can honestly say that for the most part, there's things that happen I don't like. There's things I hate. But they go by. I get over them. And for the most part, I'm a reasonably happy man. It's because of people like you in rooms like this and working those steps. And I'm down to 10, 9, 8, 7. I want to thank you all very much for the privilege of being able to stand here and share my little piece of the story. I'm not a big deal. So, thank you.
Can't take an alcoholic anywhere. See, thanks again for Bob. Give him another round of hands. Thank you so much. And I have asked Mickey to come up and do the chips.
My name is Mickey. I'm an alcoholic.
I'm Mickey.
Here at the 8 o'clock Blue Chip Speakers meeting, we use chips to denote our time in sobriety. The first chip is a white chip. If you want to surrender, choose this way of life. Anybody want a white chip?
Okay.
Back. Anybody else? After 30 days, you get a silver chip. Anybody got 30 days?
Oh, wow. You've never gotten 30 again. Keep coming, sweet.
Red chip for 90 days. 3 months. Yellow chip for 6 months. Got a green chip for 9 months. Anybody have 9 months today?
That's our speaker
now. Any blue chip for birthdays? Multiples? Any birthdays? No? You're off the white chip twice?
Why is that?
Because we were nodding. But if you want to come up and get one later, it's up here. Be grateful for the chips you have.
Okay, thank you one and all for joining the Blue Chip Speakers meeting.
Strange to me.
town. Can't put the bottle down. Right now feels like it's killing me. Life out here gets so depressing. Need something to take the edge, you see.